And we're back. Hey, welcome back to Big Mike's Movie Podcast, second edition here. Mike and Graham's Oscar extravaganza. How you doing today, Graham? Oh. Outstanding. Glad to hear it. Hey, you got a birthday coming up today. That's right. Big Graham's 25th birthday party. Looking forward to it, are you? Well, hey, I am too. Hey, if you're going to be in Hollywood tonight, it's going to be down at the Cat and Fiddle on Sunset Boulevard. Come on down. Big Mike's Movie Podcast is going to be in effect. Street Team will be there handing out t-shirts, tickets. Come on in. Buy Graham a drink. Tell him you said happy birthday. Oh, wait. This is an internet radio show.
By the time they hear this.
Right. But
party's going to be over.
Party's going to be over, yeah. No, but, you know, maybe they can use their Wayback Machine to come by and say hi. Yeah.
That'd be fun. Yeah. How you doing, man?
I'm awesome. It's a rainy day today.
Again.
Last time we were here.
Oh, last time it was.
It was a nice, bright, sunny day. And, you know, I think it fits the mood of this year's Oscars, because in the last couple of weeks, they've turned dark, haven't they?
Excellent segue, my friend. Excellent.
Yeah.
Back with the second edition, the follow-up, as it were, the 0.5. So the first episode. We've got editing to talk about today.
We do, yeah.
Best director, and of course, the large field of Best Picture nominees.
Obviously, the big thing this year with the Oscars is that they've expanded it, the Best Picture field, to 10 nominees. And a lot of people think that it was in response to last year, pictures like The Dark Knight or WALL-E not being nominated for Best Picture.
Right.
Very critically well-received, as well as commercially successful. Now, if that was the reason, which I think you and I agree on, do you feel like this field of 10 is kind of like correcting that mistake? Is it getting them to where they want to be?
Well, when you look at the 10 pictures that are nominated this year, I mean, they do span the field of what the Academy wanted. You have huge box office successes. You have smaller films that were very critically acclaimed. You have, you know, industry films that are headed by people that are you know, much respected in the industry and in Hollywood. So you've got an interesting cross-section. But on the other hand, if you take a look at what a lot of people are presuming to be the top five nominees, the ones that, if there weren't 10 nominees, they would be the five. And those are the five movies that are nominated for Best Director, which are Avatar, Hurt Locker, Inglourious Bastards, Precious, and Up in the Air. Those five films also represent that. You have Avatar, hugely successful. I mean, it's the top grossing film of all time at this point. You've got Inglourious Bastards, critically acclaimed and also, you know, grossed over $100 million, so very big success. And you have Up in the Air, directed by Jason Reitman, who is respected and has already been nominated in the past. And you have, like, a movie like The Hurt Locker, which is incredibly respected, a lot of critical acclaim, almost no box office at all. So it has a good sampling of what the Academy was going for anyway. That I don't think that this year the 10 nominations were necessary for the films that ended up being nominated. But on the other hand, you know, it's gotten people talking, you know, a lot, especially the more controversial nominations like The Blind Side have gotten a lot of people talking about the Oscars this year. And having 10 nominees in the first place before there were nominations had a lot of people discussing the Oscars and are the Oscars relevant? How is this going to change the game? So it really raised the interest through, you know, the summer months when no one really is paying much attention to the Academy at all. So in that sense, it's been successful. But if you're looking strictly from a movie sense, I think that it was perhaps a bit unnecessary for 2009.
One thing that I did want to talk about that we had mentioned a lot in the first podcast, the idea of the nomination as a win. Now, you and I are fond of using that expression. We say it a lot, and we also believe it. And right. There are a lot of people who kind of casually watch the Oscars or don't really follow award seasons who think that that's insincere, for lack of a, for as a euphemism. They think that that's a bunch of crap and don't believe that all those people who say just to be nominated is such an honor.
Right.
But I think, as you and I know, people truly are honored by a nomination, humbled by a nomination, that a nomination is something that, like a win, they can ride for a long time on.
How many movie trailers do you watch that say, you know, Academy Award nominee, you know,
Jeff Bridges?
Yeah. Academy Award nominee Jeff Bridges.
You know. We say that a lot. We use it a lot. I know you think it's true. Is it? And why do you think some people have a problem believing that?
I think for a lot of people sitting at home, you know, they see the Oscars being the big prize, and it's sort of, it becomes this competition when you're watching the show. There's this horse race, you know, there's five nominees, you know, there's one winner and there's four losers. And most of the time when you hear people say the nomination is the win is when they, you know, when they win the Oscar and they go, it was just an honor to be nominated. I didn't expect this, blah, blah, blah. But I think for a lot of actors, especially when you look at, you know, perhaps older actors or actors that have really struggled in the industry, I mean, an Oscar nomination, even if they don't win, and even if they're never nominated again, you know, it represents something. You know, it's not nothing to be nominated for an Oscar. It takes a large group of people to vote for you. It's like, you know, no one wins an Oscar because they hate another movie. No one wins an Oscar because they're not liked. No one gets nominated because they're not liked. So obviously there's a group of people who like your work that you were able to be nominated. And for a lot of people, you know, that, for most people, I think, that in and of itself is the reward. And in some ways, I think winning an Oscar is a, kind of a bit of a hassle because, you know, you have to go up on stage and you have to give a speech and you may be shy or that may not be your thing. I mean, look at Jennifer Connelly. When she won her Oscar, she was, you know, deer in the headlights.
Well, see, now you say that and that makes people seem less sympathetic towards actors. Like, they get paid millions of dollars to, you know, play around and then they're like, oh, I don't want to do that. That's the work part. Isn't that what they get paid for? You know, to promote the movie, that's where they get paid. That's where they earn their paycheck.
Well, true, but I mean, even if you look at the actors nominated this year, I mean, I know the theory is, oh, they get paid to go put on a costume and play pretend, but a lot of the nominees this year, no, really a lot of the nominees any year come from, you know, somewhat smaller films. They probably weren't paid that much. You know, I'm sure Jeremy Renner didn't make that much money off of Hurt Locker. Certainly, Gabourey didn't make that much money doing Precious. There wasn't enough money to go around. So, I mean, this is kind of worth more than the salary to them because it kind of for actors who, you know, don't get a lot of work, but suddenly they're nominated for an Oscar. I mean, it can be a catalyst to finding more work. It certainly, you know, I think an actor like Jeremy Renner can take this Oscar nomination and probably find himself a movie franchise if that's what he wants to do. He could end up playing, you know, The Flash or whatever.
I see him. He was being rumored to be a Hawkeye.
Oh,
that'd be a good one, right?
That could be interesting.
That'd be an interesting take on the character. Or the Green Arrow.
I think right.
That would be a good one. Just kind of
although, honestly, I would rather, I'd rather see Jeremy Renner not do films like that.
Now, there's a saying that there's three pictures that you make. There's the movie that you write, there's the movie that you shoot, and there's the movie that you cut. So film editing plays a huge part in the final product of a film. I don't think too many people kind of casually watch it, you know, really recognize that. But the nominees for editing really kind of run the spectrum of different styles of film editing. It's Avatar, District 9, The Hurt Locker, Inglourious Basterds, and Precious. Again, obviously we see Hurt Locker and we see Avatar, and we think this is another one of the awards where they're going to battle it out. And it probably will come down to one of them. And this award is kind of a wash. It could kind of go either way. My preference is that District 9 wins. It had a lot of different styles, right. A lot of special effects on a very small budget. A lot of it was digital. They had the video look to it, a very documentary feel. And the editing and the pace of it really helped tell the story. It's a large part of why that movie worked. You work in post-production in your job. You work with a lot of editors, people that know a lot about the styles and the technical aspect of it. What do they think is going to win? What do you think is going to win? What would they like to see win?
Well, like you were saying, I think in a way editing comes down to Avatar and Hurt Locker. Editing is one of those categories that people who are editors understand the art of editing. And really editing is kind of an invisible art. You know, the best editing is the editing that you don't see or that doesn't draw attention to itself. But of course, the majority of the Academy and, you know, the majority of the film audience doesn't really, I think, understand the art of editing. It's like with cinematography, it's not pretty pictures, it's good lighting. With editing, it's not flashy cuts necessarily, although that gets a lot of attention here, and also films that have like multiple storylines that follow people around get a lot of attention. You know, films like Traffic and Crash, well, maybe aren't necessarily the best edited films of the year, but there's this idea that you have to juggle all these storylines, and really that's more
in writing the script, yeah,
than in the editing of the film. But there aren't really any films like that this year so much. I mean, Inglourious Basterds has a few different storylines, but they're all relatively self-contained.
And that's Tarantino style. People are used to it at this point, where his films, you know, cut back and forth, jump back and forth in time, you know, or telling different stories and different characters. So, you know, it's nothing that they haven't seen specifically from him.
It does draw attention to itself, but that's part of the film. I mean, that's part of the fabric of the film. Film editing, really, when it comes down to what film would win, comes down to what film is probably going to win Best Picture. Because in years past, film editing has been pretty decent bellwether for Best Picture. I mean, it doesn't always work out that way, but, you know, Crash won Best Editing and then it won Best Picture. It's something that a lot of people just sort of understand as being, you know, the film was well put together. They also like the film, so they like the way the film was put together, so they're going to vote for this film. And if we're talking, you know, generally right now what the feeling is, you know, Hurt Locker seems to be the front runner at the moment. The editors that I talk to like the Hurt Locker, and they like the work in the Hurt Locker, and they don't necessarily think that Hurt Locker perhaps was the strongest film as far as editing is concerned, although certainly there's a lot of admiration of in the technique of drawing tension and suspense, which is a huge part of what makes the Hurt Locker work. Right. But like you were saying, they're more impressed with a film like District 9, which uses a lot of different media. It's not a traditional narrative. It's sort of, there's a faux documentary element to it, which kind of subsides as time goes by. It's kind of a, like the film itself, it's kind of a haphazardly put together, but it works for what it is. It's a very strange creature. And I think a lot of the success of District 9 as a film, you know, besides, you know, pretty seamless visual effects and a strong story and, you know, a good lead performance is definitely in the editing and the way that the film was assembled. So editors I know think that a film like District 9 should win the Oscar for editing. But, you know, realistically, I think most people are looking at, you know, Hurt Locker or Avatar to win here. The general feeling now, and especially since, you know, since in the last couple of weeks since the nominations have been announced, is that, you know, there's definitely a lot of heat on Avatar at first that's been cooling off.
Right.
Most definitely. Avatar has kind of become a bit of a, I wouldn't call it a pariah necessarily, but a lot of people are very anti-Avatar because of what it can mean for the future of their jobs and of other jobs in the industry. So really to recognize Avatar in fields other than, like, say, visual effects plays a lot against Avatar winning in other categories where it could or should win. But I think we're looking at Hurt Locker here for editing.
Great. Now we get into the big guns, all right, and there's Best Director. The nominees for directing are James Cameron for Avatar, Catherine Bigelow for The Hurt Locker, Quentin Tarantino for Inglourious Basterds, Lee Daniels for Precious, and Jason Reitman for Up in the Air. Now, Catherine Bigelow's already won the DGA award, made history there.
Mm-hmm.
She's clearly the front runner to win. It does kind of come down to her and James Cameron, but especially, you know, recently, Cameron's kind of stayed out of the limelight a lot, really kind of downplayed what people expect him to be. You know, people really look at him as like, what's a nice way of saying he's fooling himself?
Is there a nice way of saying
he's fooling king himself? Of the world, right?
Well, sure.
You know, and that's what a lot of people remember him for, especially at the Oscars. He already has an Oscar. For Titanic, for another movie that people thought was okay, but, you know, appreciated the spectacle of it, the epic scope.
Right.
Gave him an Oscar for it. Don't think he's going to win. Tarantino, he's had a great year. Coming from Cannes, I mean, people didn't even think he could put this movie together in as quickly as he said that he could. You know, a few years ago when he said, we're going to have this out next year. And he's... His year has been marked by what I like to think of his maturity as a director. You know, when he first came on, he was the rock star director, and he was very egotistical, and people had all these, you know, preconceived notions about him. And now he's really become that nominee that the Academy likes, where it's an honor to be nominated.
Right.
I wish everybody could win. He's really behind Catherine. He has vocally supported her and said that she deserves to win.
he's got a great story going on this year. Again, I don't think he wins. I think it goes to Catherine Bigelow. Jason Reitman is the second nomination after Juno. Lee Daniels, it's a great first nomination for him. A very strong Oscar debut. Everything seems to be going Catherine Bigelow's way.
Right.
Will she win? And if she doesn't, who's going to steal it from her?
I don't even, with all due respect to your question, I don't even know if I need to pick an alternate with this. I mean, the odd thing about director this year, the odd thing about director, you know, as opposed to any Oscar race, I think, is that all the other nominees are conceding to Catherine. They're saying, hey, give it to Catherine Bigelow. And it's almost to the point where if there was a contest, there was no contest. But even if they weren't doing that, I think that definitely the feeling and the thought is to give it to Catherine Bigelow for Best Director. I mean, there are many ways that you can look at, you know, why she's going to win Best Director. You know, you can go with the obvious, she's a woman and a woman hasn't won, and this is the best chance a woman has had so far to win an Oscar, especially because the other three women that have been nominated in this category have directed more, if you want, female-centric films, which is a very broad look. I mean, certainly that describes The Piano, but I don't know if that necessarily describes Lost in Translation. But there's you may perhaps a female point of view that a male director wouldn't have given the film. Whereas with Hurt Locker, you know, in a way, it could have been, the subject matter could have been directed by a man and you would have had a very strong film there. The fact that it's directed by a woman, for some reason, people have latched onto that as being even more of a reason to vote for her here.
Well, some of those things, too, that they say you shouldn't say about her. Like, you shouldn't say that it's because she's a woman, or you shouldn't say it because she's making an action film. Those things actually work a lot in her favor in a way that people aren't willing to talk about because they don't want to seem, you know, prejudiced.
Right.
But the fact that she has made an action movie speaks very highly of her talent as a director.
Right.
The fact that you know, this little small action movie is nominated for Best Picture is doing a large part to her. She was one of the main driving forces behind even getting this movie to the screen.
Right.
And it's very much you know, indicative of her talent as a director, like Inglourious Basterds is of Tarantino.
Right.
You know, you said before that Tarantino's the star of Basterds. And as much as, you know, Jason Reitman has a lot of himself in the Up in the Air movie, Catherine Bigelow, really, the Hurt Locker is completely her movie. Yeah.
That could be true almost with any of these nominees, I think, in respect to, they're all films that probably wouldn't have been made if they didn't have these directors attached to them and this much passion and power. I mean, certainly Hurt Locker and Precious are films that had a horrible time getting financing even when the directors were on board, but they had a vision and they stayed true to that and they really wanted to push their ideas and their film and to get the film made because they believe in the subject matter so much. And in the case of Hurt Locker and Precious, I think that's kind of odd because this is work that the directors found. The directors found these scripts and these writers. They didn't write these scripts, as opposed to Cameron and Tarantino and Reitman, who did write their scripts. You know, and then again, they fought for their own vision and the way they wanted to make their films. But they had a little bit of an easier time in terms of financing and getting studios on board, more so than Lee Daniels and Catherine Bigelow. And that also plays into a strength for Catherine Bigelow and why she'd win is because, you know, through sheer will of personality and getting people to believe in her and the confidence that she had in her material, she was able to get the movie made. I think that that's, a job of a director that doesn't normally get a lot of attention. I think when people think of directors, they think of people calling cut in action and maybe sitting in an editing booth with an editor putting something together, although certainly that's not how most Hollywood movies are made these days. You know, but they were champions of their film, and she was a champion of her film, and I think that is a big reason for why she'll win director, besides the fact that people just like the film. An odd thing with Hurt Locker's kind of awards trajectory is people, I guess, behind the scenes who are doing publicity for it have really pushed it as, you know, it was this film that nobody wanted to make. And part of the reason for that is because it had this very masculine storyline and a woman attached to direct. She wasn't going to, I mean, The Hurt Locker wasn't going to be made without Catherine Bigelow. So it had a hard time getting you know, financial backing and people to fund the film. And finally, when it did, you know, it was sort of this little film that could. That's become a huge part of the story for the Best Picture campaign. And certainly that feeds into Kathryn Bigelow's campaign as Best Director.
Now, if I had the deep pockets and someone told me, hey, the chick that made Point Break wants to make another war movie, I'd be like, here's my signature, and you fill out the amount and just get back to me when you got something in the can.
The weird thing to me going through this whole Oscar season is how everyone seems to be discovering Kathryn Bigelow now, to the point where someone goes, who's Kathryn Bigelow? And I say, you know, well, she directed The Hurt Locker. And they're like, oh, great. What else did she direct? And I go, well, you know, she directed Point Break. The first thing that comes out of their mouth is, wait, Point Break was directed by a woman? Like, there's so much, you know, of her work out there that's kind of become part of pop culture. But for some reason, she's never really been attached to that. No one's ever really paid attention to her as a personality, which, you know, she's, as we've seen in other award shows, she's not a big force of personality. She's not a James Cameron type as far as her ego and just her sheer charisma is concerned. She has a more zen quality to her. But no one's really kind of attached her films to her until now. And now people are going back and rediscovering, you know, oh, she did, you know, Point Break. Oh, she did, you know, Near Dark. And, she did
Strange Days.
And that these are great films that sort of got overlooked. And now people are appreciating them more because of Hurt Locker. And looking at her past films, she's reached a career pinnacle with The Hurt Locker. The Hurt Locker represents, you know, the best film that she's ever made. It's a testament to her craft and everything that she's learned over the last 20 years as a director. And that goes along with a very popular, if you will, Oscar storyline with directors where, you know, directors are very good and, you know, they're well respected and they're getting better and better. And then finally they do their best work. That doesn't obviously always follow with, you know, directors like Scorsese getting passed over for their best work for a film that's, you know, good, but certainly not a classic like a Raging Bull or a Goodfellas. But, you know, he's sort of the exception to the rule. She follows, I guess, kind of that Danny Boyle, Ong Lee kind of career trajectory of making these great solid films and then suddenly...
Coens.
Yeah, the Coens. So that's... She falls into that. So if you didn't have Woman and you didn't have Independent, you have best film she's ever made. So you put all three together, and I mean, that's a recipe for Oscar. Yeah,
gold.
I mean, yeah,
it's gold, baby. All right, so let me get into the main focus this episode, Best Picture. And there's 10 nominees, and they're Avatar, The Blind Side, District 9, An Education, The Hurt Locker, Inglourious Basterds, Precious, A Serious Man, Up, and Up in the Air. Kind of want to take it out of order, and so we're going to start with Up. First animated feature nominated for Best Picture since Beauty and the Beast.
Right.
It is a huge nomination for Pixar. I mean, they've been pushing for it every year since Nemo and
right.
The Incredibles.
Yeah.
They've been trying to get on for Best Picture. A lot of people thought they would get there last year with WALL-E. They didn't.
Which is part of the reason why we have 10 nominees.
Part of the reason why we have 10 nominees.
Yeah.
And there are some people who don't think that Up is necessarily as good as WALL-E and that Up's nomination is to help make up for the fact that WALL-E didn't. I think Up stands alone as a film by itself, and it deserves this nomination. What keeps it from winning?
Well, what keeps it from winning is, I think, the fear that since there's been an animated feature category that animated film fans have had, which is if an animated film ever gets nominated for Best Picture, it's not going to win because it'll win animated feature.
Right.
I mean, Up is winning animated feature. There's really no question about that. And, you know, that hurts it as far as Best Picture is concerned, not looking at the other nominees. And like you were saying, there is a perception. A lot of people really love Up. It's a great film, you know, on its own right, but it's not thought of necessarily as Pixar's best. It's not WALL-E. It's not The Incredibles. It's not Nemo. Which is not to say it's second tier, and it's certainly not, you know, Cars, but it's not quite at that level, although there are moments of brilliance in the film. Most people point to the first 10 minutes of Up as being, you know, some of the best animation ever.
Yeah.
But, you know, compare that to Pixar's past record, and it doesn't hold up, and as it were. And Up... benefits from having the 10 nominees, because I think that if there weren't 10 nominees this year, we wouldn't be seeing Up in this category.
The next one is A Serious Man. Now, this is one you went to go see. You actually had some rather different opinions on it.
Right.
Let's get into those without being as anti-Semitic as possible.
Sure. Right. Well, I can recognize when I don't get a film. Like, I certainly don't get Wes Anderson films. It's really not my bag. Not to alienate large chunks of the audience, but
me
or you. But you know, I just don't get it. I see The Craft certainly, but I don't get it. The same goes with The Serious Man. You know, I'll be the first person to say I'm not the biggest Coen Brothers fan. There are a lot of Coen Brothers films that I like a lot. You know, I like No Country. I liked Fargo. I like Blood Simple. And I kind of like their more, oddly, of their more serious or darker films. A Serious Man, I don't think, really falls into that category. It's certainly not as zany as, say, like a, you know, Raising Arizona. But it falls into kind of a weird zone for them. And to me, I just didn't get A Serious Man. However, I do understand why a lot of people and why a lot of Oscar voters understood and enjoyed A Serious Man, obviously enough for it to be nominated for Best Picture over other films.
They're called Jewish. You just said.
Okay, well, there you go. There you go.
I said it, so you didn't
have okay, to. Yeah. So now I'm not the anti-Semite, I guess. I like Woody Allen films.
Love Mel Brooks.
Sure. But, no, A Serious Man is a film that definitely has benefited from there being 10 Best Picture nominees. We wouldn't be talking about it in this category if there were only 5. And it was probably on the cusp of not being nominated, you know, along with the films that weren't nominated, films like, you know, A Single Man or The Messenger, these strong films that also had pockets of support that were probably just not as big as, say, A Serious Man is. You know, people still love the Coens, and a lot of that probably went into A Serious Man.
Well, see, now, you know that one of my big things, too, one of my pet peeves, is Best Picture nominees that don't have any acting nominations along with it.
Right.
I can understand a movie that maybe doesn't get nominated for screenplay, maybe doesn't have any technical awards, but when a movie is nominated for Best Picture and wins, especially, with no acting nominations,
right,
it's Lord of the Rings. And
or Slumdog Millionaire.
Slumdog, you know, I didn't want to.
Oh right,
I didn't want to beat that movie up because it took a pounding in the last podcast. But you see what I'm saying. And A Single Man doesn't have any of those. And like you said, it may have taken a nomination away from Last Station, or Crazy Heart, or The Messenger. You know, a movie that might have gotten a push into the top 10 and didn't.
Right.
Admittedly. You know, A Serious Man has a very limited appeal. It has not won a broad audience.
No.
It has not done a lot of box office.
Right.
But the audience that it's focused on are people that vote and people that work in this industry and people of a certain persuasion that see a lot of themselves in the movie and really like it.
And really connect with it. In a way, A Serious Man and its nomination kind of also represents a lot of the complaints that have come up with the Oscars recently, which is that it's a little self-indulgent and it caters specifically to their taste, which the Oscars aren't the People's Choice Awards.
Right.
They don't have to be populist at all. They represent, you know, an area of the community, and albeit a very small membership of the community. I mean, there's only some 5,000 members of the Academy. There are far more people that work in Hollywood. So this does not represent Hollywood as a whole. But, you know, it represents their taste, and a lot of people in middle America will see a film like A Serious Man, even if they don't know what A Serious Man is, and go, well, you know, clearly they don't know what they're talking about because they're not nominating, you know, Transformers.
But see, the fact that they have chosen an unpopular choice kind of goes in the face of what they're trying to do this year, specifically with the 10 nominees.
Right.
You understand? And that's just my only point in saying that where people in middle America will love to go see A Crazy Heart.
Sure.
Would probably go see A Messenger too. They will skip out.
Serious.
Now, the issues that we talked about with Serious Man almost go hand in hand with some of the issues with the next film, and that's Precious.
Right.
It's a movie that's very small, not a lot of big actors in it.
Right.
Is very well received critically. Has not done a lot box office wise, but also has a very limited appeal and has a very limited audience. Now, interestingly enough, unlike A Serious Man, the audience that this is aimed to, which is a largely black audience, is not the audience that's responding to it. They have issues with it for a lot of reasons.
Right.
Including Lee Daniels himself, the director. A lot of black people don't necessarily agree with him. There's not a lot of big black actors in it. It's Mariah Carey and it's Lenny Kravitz and a lot of people that are, for one reason or another, not thought to be very African American. And right. It is a very dark story, a very serious story about abuse and about the black community, in which a lot of black audiences are not responding to. That being said, there are not a lot of black voters, and it's not hurt it. The people that vote, the people that watch these movies, have really responded to Precious.
Right.
It puts it in this weird place where it's connecting with the people that matter and not the people that it was made for. Ultimately, is that going to hurt its chances for Best Picture?
I think that Precious not appealing perhaps as much to the black community isn't so much an issue with, say, the black community as it is kind of with films of Precious's ilk in America today, which is that, you know, in general, America doesn't want to see, you know, dark, depressing films with heavy subject matter. They want to go to the theater and see, you know, Paul Blart or whatever. You know, they want to see lighter fare, which, you know, Precious, you know, even after watching Precious, I mean, you leave not wanting to cut yourself, but I mean, it's not necessarily the most hopeful ending there. So, I mean, it's not necessarily an uplifting story, but it does.
I was just going to say, you say that, yeah. But Dark Knight last year was crazy at the box office.
Right.
Departed won before that.
Right.
No Country won before that. These are films that are very serious and very violent. Is it all right because of, you know, the ethnic makeup of the cast? Do you think that really has a large part to play in it? Because I honestly do. I think that if Precious was a movie with an all-white cast, that it would not be as well-received, that it would not be acclaimed as much as it is. Right. And for me, it's just interesting because I think that that it being a black movie has garnered a lot of acclaim. Not that it doesn't deserve it. It's a very well-made movie.
It makes it stand out in the marketplace more.
Exactly.
Right.
It makes it stand out as basically it's the only movie on this list with a black lead.
Playing a black person.
I wasn't talking about Avatar.
Yeah.
But you understand what I'm saying? Like, it kind of has that in it. And that's all, is that the movie and what it represents is really interesting to me in this Oscar race, just for that matter. And like I said, it kind of goes with A Serious Man, which, you know, the audience and you know, its appeal.
Precious also has kind of factored into this race because it's had all this momentum all year. I mean, it premiered at Sundance back in January 2009, like an Education, and it's just had this this momentum and this drive. You know, Oprah latched onto it, Tyler Perry latched onto it. They helped promote the film and they got the film out there. And, you know, it's been a part of awards talk since this time last year.
They helped to get it out there. But like you said, and like we talked about before, Tyler Perry's audience is not the people that are going to go see Precious.
No.
Oprah's audience, they kind of are.
Right.
You know, the her white female audience, the blindsiders, if you will.
Sure, yeah.
They're going to go see Precious. But Why Did I Get Married To are not going to go see Precious.
No, and it is, we can continue to discuss it, but it is odd, and there's not really a clear answer why it just didn't connect. But, you know, hopefully, I think as time goes on and, you know, we go through the Oscars, Precious wins an Oscar or two, you know, it's not that, I don't think there's anybody really who pays attention to films who doesn't know about Precious at this point. But it might turn some heads. It might get some people to watch the film, you know, after they actually see Monique win the Oscar or whatnot, you know?
Hopefully it'll get Lee Daniels some more work, and maybe we can see him with a bigger budget and some bigger actors in a more studio project that more people will see.
But definitely. I think, you know, Lee Daniels isn't winning Best Director, but, you know, he deserves to be nominated due solely to the fact of, you know, that he was able to get these great performances out of these actors who were either untrained or
musicians or comedians.
Musicians or comedians. You know, it's not a traditional cast. I mean, with the exception probably of Paula Patton, it's not a traditional actor cast. So, you know, if he can do that with people who aren't actors, I mean, I wouldn't say let's get him some real actors and see what he can pull out. I'd say, you know, let's get him more people like this into another vehicle and see what we can pull out.
I just look at it like Chris Nolan. Like, he had the little small movie with Memento, had a few actors in it, it was really well received. And then his next one, they gave him Academy Award winner Hilary Swank, Academy Award winner Robin Williams, Academy Award winner Al Pacino, and, like, you know, he made a really great movie, and now he's doing Inception, and he's doing Batman. You know what I mean? The potential for Lee Daniels to make bigger and potentially better movies is there, and I'm really interested in seeing that from him.
Definitely. It'll be great to see over this decade, you know, where Lee Daniels factors in at the end of this. I think there's definitely a lot of goodwill, and I wouldn't be surprised if he ended up being nominated for another Oscar within the next, you know, 10 years.
Yeah, hopefully he doesn't take the John Singleton route. you mentioned an education. We're going to talk about that one real quick. Like you said, it premiered at Sundance, and the buzz was huge. Specifically for Carey Mulligan, it seems that her performance has carried a lot of the Oscar hype around the picture. Its only other nominations... Yeah. I didn't realize that. The only other nominations besides Best Picture are for her and for the screenplay.
Right.
So, doesn't win Best Picture.
No.
It's just a huge vehicle for Carey Mulligan and also for Nick Hornby, who we talked about before. What keeps it from winning Best Picture?
Well, an education's problem in here is that, you know, it's a film that I think critics and, you know, sort of the awards voters over the awards season have kind of latched onto as one of those, you know, good quality films that they find and they're gonna go with and they're gonna keep with. It's not necessarily if you want a great film. I mean, it is a good film, and I saw it and I enjoyed it, and it's one of my favorite films of last year. But, you know, I wouldn't necessarily call it Best Picture, and I don't know. You know, I think maybe it got enough attention at the Oscars. I think maybe Alfred Molina could have ended up with the supporting actor nod. That would have made me perhaps a little happy. But, you know, it's not a Best Picture film, and that hurts it from being considered seriously for Best Picture. Is that it is lighter fare, and it's not, you know, it's just not a film that really connected with a larger audience. It doesn't have a lot of momentum other than, you know, the magnetism and the personality of Carey Mulligan. And as you're saying, the script and sort of rock star element to having Nick Hornby write the screenplay of it. You know, one thing that we didn't discuss when we were talking about Best Actress, but something that I've kind of noticed and has kind of come up, and an idea that has been carried by Sasha Stone on her awards daily site is that the idea that Carey Mulligan kind of, as crass as it might sound, kind of falls into that range of you know, nominees and actresses that you know, older male white voters see and go, oh, she's cute and bubbly. Oh, she's falling for an older guy. You know, like, that's a very appealing and attractive character and character trait to see. And that makes people gravitate towards that character. You know, I think the same could be said, obviously, with Maggie Gyllenhaal's character in Crazy Heart. Yeah. But, you know, certainly, you know, I wouldn't go as crass as Sasha is, and I'm not going to say it here. But, I mean, I think there's that element of she's cute and she's attractive, and that's helped carry the film a lot. I think if it was a different actress, if it was different subject matter, we wouldn't see it here. But there's something about it that clicks with Oscar voters.
The next two movies are, everybody's widely acknowledged that they are direct recipients of the expanded Field of 10. Now, the first one, District 9, is one that we both saw, that we both really enjoyed.
Right.
Really happy to see it in there. Just for the sheer fact of look what they did with such little money. So very creative, very innovative as a movie.
Right.
And we're glad to see it up there.
Definitely.
The other one is The Blind Side.
Right.
Which is almost the antithesis of District 9, although I would say the Avatar is.
Probably, yeah.
But Blind Side is a movie it's a sports movie that doesn't have to do about sports. Mm-hmm. It's a very feel-good, formulaic movie. Mostly driven by the sheer star power of Sandra Bullock,
And a lot of people feel that her performance aside, it's not a movie that's worthy of Best Picture and has snubbed out something like Star Trek.
Right.
Crazy Heart. Invictus.
Right.
And that it's one of those movies that has taken away a spot from something else.
Mm-hmm.
It balances out the fact that District 9 is in there because that was the one that was on the bubble a lot and people weren't really sure of. But specifically, how did the nominations of District 9 and The Blind Side affect this experiment of 10 Best Picture nominations?
Well, if you want to discuss District 9 first, as you know, you brought it up first, mm-hmm. I think District 9 is a great example of a film that, you know, was a critical hit, was a surprise big commercial hit. I mean, it grossed over $100 million here in the States. You know, it's a film that just sort of clicked, and
it's a foreign film.
It's from South Africa, and produced with Australian or New Zealand money. You know, it's not a Hollywood picture at all, but it hits every point that like Hollywood films want to hit, but they don't for whatever reason. You know, because they're made by a committee or whatever reasoning you want to find. Instead, District 9 is a film with a very strong point of view from its director and its production team. And it found itself.
Well, it works as a movie.
Right.
It works as a genre sci-fi movie, but also has a very serious social commentary
right.
underneath it that appeals to a lot of voters. You know, people like the Gandhis and they like the Schindler's List and they like movies with a message.
Definitely a movie with a message, yeah.
You're right. And they like the big spectacles. And District 9 has both of those while still being a very small, movie. You know, no stars.
Right.
So to speak of. Very limited effects budget. But it works, and works really well. And I think, obviously, the nomination is their reward for them. Definitely the nomination as a win. But why does that not work for Blindside? Blindside is, you know, a feel-good story,
right.
and a very strong performance, and football. Americans like football.
Sure.
But there's been a lot of backlash to it.
When The Blindside was released, you know, critics weren't kind to it at all. I think even the most lukewarm critics were kind of like, yeah, it's you know, a decent Thanksgiving film. You know,
right.
you can't. It came out around Thanksgiving, and it wasn't even number one the first weekend it came out. I mean, it was a film that, you know, no one really had much expectation of, even the studio that released it. And suddenly, it scrapped together this campaign because it was making a lot of money. Critics and Oscar fans are going to complain about The Blind Side's nomination clearly because, you know. For the most part, it is definitely a formula film. It's blocked a nomination from a more worthy film from an artistic standpoint. On the other side, you know, the Oscars wanted to expand to 10 nominees to get more big box office hits. Now, last year had big box office hits that got snubbed from being nominated for Best Picture that were critical hits as well as big commercial hits. Whereas Blindside doesn't fall into that so much, but I mean, it's made a huge amount of money. And it's the very fact that it's being nominated, even though no one, even in middle America, is taking it seriously as a contender to win, is going to draw a lot of viewers to the telecast. And ultimately, I mean, that's why we've got 10 nominees this year, is to get people to watch the Oscars. So Blindside's going to probably go down as one of those embarrassments of the Academy. I think maybe even now, a lot of people involved in the Academy are a little embarrassed that it was nominated. But, you know, it's the Best Picture nominee. You can't take that away from it. So.
No, you certainly cannot. It'll be on the DVD cover.
Yeah. Oh, God.
Now, my favorite film of this year, I don't necessarily think it was the best film. I don't necessarily think that it's going to win Best Picture. But Up in the Air is a film that you and I saw together.
Right.
I walked out of it the same way I walked out of Revolutionary Road. I was just completely floored and taken away, but with a much more upbeat attitude.
Right.
Than I had out of Revolutionary Road.
Right.
It's a movie that has got crushed critically and commercially. Just blindsided, if you will. Not only by that movie, but by Avatar, released around December the same time as Avatar. Nobody got to see it because everybody was going to go see Avatar.
Right.
Critically, it was released at a time when a lot of the first awards and reviews and Critics' Choice Awards were coming out.
Mm-hmm.
And it got swept away, blown away, as it were, by the Hurt Locker.
Right.
You're like, I'm fine.
Sure.
Up in the Air is an amazing picture. And everybody that sees it, most for the most part, falls in love with it. It's got a 92%. Rating on Rotten Tomatoes, which is excellent. I think Hurt Locker might be the only movie that's got a better rating on it this year.
how did this happen? How did the star power of George Clooney and the lineage and the previous nominations of Jason Reitman just get swept away by these two other movies?
Up in the Air's problem, I think, has always been, you know, by the time it finally got released, you know, everybody was assuming it was going to be a big Oscar picture. I mean, it had premiered at Venice, I believe, and it just kept going from there. I mean, and everyone had been talking about, you know, this is going to be a big Oscar film. George Clooney's going to win a second Oscar, you know, and big Best Picture contender. And indeed, when we walked out of it, we were saying, this film's going to win Best Picture. It's got everything that Oscar likes. You know, it definitely appeals to that white, middle-aged male vote that is a big chunk of the Academy. You know, there's nothing wrong in the film. The film is definitely a Best Picture type film. But I think there was this perception that people were expecting something even greater than what it was, which it's a good, solid, you know, piece of art. But it's not anything more than that. And so there was all this buzz, and it couldn't help but be defeated by its own buzz. And ultimately that's killed its awards chances. As far as like the box office is concerned, which would have helped give it another boost, like if it had made $100 million, you know, is probably due in part A to the subject matter. You know, it kind of deals with, you know, job layoffs and the down economy, and in a way kind of tangentially. Yes. But also with its own promotion. It's a hard film to pin down. It's not a film that you can summarize in a sentence, unlike Avatar or even Hurt Locker. So it's a film that it's hard to market. Once people see it, they love it. They tell other people to see it. But the real task is getting people to see it. And in a way, Paramount couldn't get that this year. And so it got crushed by that. It got crushed by its own weight, unfortunately.
Now, the next picture is one that blew the roof off of everybody, critically and commercially. Inglourious Basterds came out of Cannes and did not stop. Great box office for Tarantino. I think it's probably his highest grossing picture to date.
I believe it is, yeah.
Rave reviews on him. Everybody's like, Tarantino's back in form. I myself was one that was not one. I did not want to go see Death Proof with Nazis again.
Right.
And I think I wrote it down somewhere that I forgot that Tarantino made Pulp Fiction. Inglourious Basterds is Pulp Fiction in World War II. It's the best thing he's ever done. I don't think it wins Best Picture. My only caveat to that would be if the vote gets split between Hurt Locker and Avatar, Inglourious Basterds could be a dark horse and might pull off a win. It's certainly deserving of it. Do you think that scenario is likely?
I don't know about likely, but I think that scenario is definitely possible. I think Inglourious Basterds is in play for Best Picture. If it is, I mean, it is a surprise. I wouldn't say maybe not a surprise, but it's a dark horse candidate. But it's really the only other film besides Avatar and Hurt Locker that I think you'll see win Best Picture this year.
Well, when the nominees were announced, people were saying that it was going to be a surprise even to get nominated because it is, you know, kind of an exploitation movie. It's bloody. It's Tarantino. It's like cursing different languages and stuff like that. And they were like, well, because there's 10, it'll get nominated. If there were 5, it probably wouldn't be. And now we look at it as one of the 5. It's nominated for Best Director as well. It's in the running. And it's made that transition from being, well, it'll probably end up getting nominated, to it could win.
Right.
Which, even if it doesn't, it's a huge victory for Tarantino. A very big victory for the Weinsteins. They really needed a hit. And pushing this one and 9. This one has really paid off for them where 9 hasn't.
You know, when you look at how the Weinsteins were pushing their films, and also not forgetting that in one way or another, they were more or less pushing A Single Man and The Road as their films this year. And Single Man got a nomination. The Road got completely shut out. In a way, they've more or less mismanaged their campaigns this year, which is odd for the Weinsteins to do. But now that, you know, the dust is settled, no one really wants to vote for 9. You know, they're putting all their weight behind Inglourious Basterds. And you really, you know, love them or hate them, you can't deny the fact that Harvey Weinstein can get a lot of people to look at something and can get a lot of attention to a film. And so that kind of is, oddly, the secret weapon in Inglourious Basterds, which is hard for a lot of fans of Basterds to stomach, because I think, I'm speaking very generally, I think a lot of, you know, like, especially the internet fans of Inglourious Basterds hate Harvey Weinstein.
Right.
Because, you know, he'll buy a foreign film, chop it to death, and then release it in the theater because he thinks it'll sell better when most people just want to see a film. Things like that, where it's odd to have him be, you know, the guy on your side that's rooting for your film. But, you know, you can't really ask for a stronger cheerleader than Harvey Weinstein. And so, you know, that's going to get a lot of people interested. Some of the tactics that have come up in the campaign for Inglourious Basterds is playing up the sort of Jewish revenge aspect of it, which is definitely come into play. I've read so many articles, like in the LA Times and, you know, Hollywood Reporter, that have had, you know, screenings with rabbis and things like that, that they're, you know, people are trying to push their, you know, their people to go see this film and to, you know, their voters to vote for it and to give it a chance. I think a lot of the negative aspects of the film, as far as traditional Oscar goes, you know, the violence and the language, and a lot of the reason why a lot of people thought it wasn't going to be a nominated film and we weren't really going to talk about it at the Oscars, you know, a lot of that first impression is more or less being erased away, and people are being asked to look at it a second time. I know most people who watch the film end up liking it, if not loving it. But
it's, both of our mothers loved it,
which is very weird, especially my mother.
Especially my mom, she's not that kind of gal.
My mother probably would have voted for The Blind Side, but but now she wants to vote for Inglourious Basterds, and it's a very odd position for the film to be in. It's still an underdog; people don't think it's going to win, but it's got so many things going for it, and especially with this new voting system this year with Best Picture. You know, it could really benefit from that. So I wouldn't count Inglourious Basterds out. It could end up surprising.
Now we get down to the two favorites, nomination wise.
Yeah,
Avatar is not really a favorite anymore amongst voters.
Right.
It's not really a favorite amongst people like you and I.
Right.
It's gained a growing backlash against it for many different reasons. People don't like that this might represent the future of filmmaking. People feel that their jobs might be threatened if more movies like Avatar are made.
Right.
People don't think artistically, creatively, that it does enough as a film. They think that story's weak, acting's weak, right, direction's weak. Yet, amongst all these protests, it still could win Best Picture.
Right.
Do you think it deserves a Best Picture Oscar?
Personally, I don't think Avatar deserves this award, only in the fact that, you know, while it excels in one area as a film, and it does very well, you know, the fact that it's got amazing visual effects is not a reason to give an award to it, or give Best Picture to a film. You know, Avatar fails on so many levels, like you were saying, acting, writing, that... You know, you have a hard time with films winning Best Picture that aren't nominated for an acting award. And I kind of feel the same way. More so with a writing award than an acting award. But I still feel that, you know, there are important traditional elements that every film must have and must excel in to be a good film. And Avatar
doesn't
check all the boxes. You know, it's definitely an experience, and it's got itself a fan following. It's a spectacle. People had to go see it. I had to go see it opening weekend, and I did. And, you know, even when I was watching it, I think my reaction has become the reaction I've read about a lot of, you know, people in Hollywood, a lot of Academy and, you know, voters, is that, you know, it's a film that's great to look at, but it doesn't really draw you in, and it, you know, it doesn't have a lasting impression on you.
Are we still talking about Avatar? Because I thought you were talking about Transformers 2 for a moment.
Oh, right, right. The thing is, Avatar has sort of this prestige around it that, you know, one, if James Cameron hadn't directed it, it wouldn't have been made. But no. If it had been another filmmaker or it had been released at another time, I don't think that it'd really be factoring much in the race. Avatar kind of falls into that 9 category where 9 was getting nominated for all those awards early in the season, best pictures and acting and everything.
And then people saw it.
And then people finally saw it and realized, you know, the Emperor had no clothes. I think I think that Avatar kind of falls in that same category of, you know, sure, it's deserving of nominations for, you know, art direction and sound and visual effects. There are things in the film that are Oscar worthy. Definitely it's going to walk away with at least one Oscar on Oscar night. But, you know.
How sweet would it be if it got shut out, if it didn't win anything?
Well, that would be bizarre. Because it's such a shoo-in for, like, visual effects. I wouldn't know what film would be nominated, what film would win besides Avatar, like, in that category. But that would be a very strong message, I think, the Academy would send.
Now you think...
To studio heads, I guess.
Now you think, you've talked about it before, that you think that Hurt Locker could start racking up some of the smaller awards, and that it will be an indication that it wins Best Picture. Right now, you are on track for the Hurt Locker to win Best Picture.
Right.
I believe that as well.
Right.
We saw it together.
Right.
Arclight, Sunset, walked out of it and said that if this picture isn't nominated for Best Picture, then the entire 10 nominees experiment will be worthless.
Right.
It's got a nomination. It's now the front runner to win. Doesn't it feel good to be right?
it does. And it also, it's also odd. I mean, the Hurt Locker's nomination here is weird in the sense that, you know, it wasn't a big box office hit, and it kind of plays against why the Academy wanted to expand the field. Yet it's become so beloved in the industry, and now it's starting to find that following on video. Now that's been released on DVD and. People are seeing it. People like our moms and
people that I work with are like, hey, have you ever seen this movie? It's called The Hurt Locker. I'm like, yeah, I saw it 8 months ago.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I think, you know, it's suddenly found itself and, you know, the award season community, you know, picked up on it. It started winning like virtually every award you could find. And that's helped propel the film. I mean, it's a good, solid piece of filmmaking, and, you know, it deserved its nomination, and here it is. And
now, 2 weeks ago, when we recorded the first half of this, Hurt Locker was the juggernaut, and we were absolutely convinced 100% that it was a shoe-in to win for Best Picture.
Right.
This week, the story has been broken that one of the producers has been emailing members of the Academy, urging them not to vote for Avatar.
Right.
To vote for the Hurt Locker. They're looking at whether or not he broke any rules, what kind of restrictions are going to be on it. But is this part of a last-ditch backlash at it, similar to what happened to A Beautiful Mind?
Right.
Or some of the other pictures that Harvey Weinstein campaigned against, where these tactics come in always to the last minute, always the week before the ceremony, or 2 weeks before. How's it going to affect the film's chances to win Best Picture, because it didn't necessarily affect those other films.
Right. Well, you know, it depends on who the voter is. I mean, a lot of people get their ballots and fill it out right away and turn it right back in. There are a lot of people that wait for the last minute. The last minute is, you know, the Friday before the Oscars.
Yesterday?
Next Friday.
Oh, that Friday before? Yeah. The 2 days before?
2 days before.
Wow.
I'd hate to be one of those accounts.
I hate to be accounted, yeah.
No, but, you know, it depends on the voter. And it depends on how easily you're swayed, too. I mean, it's a smear campaign. You know, there's been, more so than the reporting of the email that's been going out, there's been a lot of investigative web journalism, if that's even exists, about who leaked it. Why is it being leaked?
That, and there's suddenly been stories cropping up too about veterans, people like myself.
Right.
Some of them that are in support of the movie, and then a lot of them that are against it, which they weren't around when the movie premiered. They weren't around when the nominations were announced.
Right.
And now the week before, 2 weeks before, they're saying this movie's unauthentic, it paints us in a bad light, the U.S. military never lended its support to it, and again, you're right. It's part of the smear campaign. It's trying to throw Hurt Locker under the bus. Do you still think it's on track to win Best Picture?
Well, I think it is. I mean, really, when you look at all the awards that it's won, I mean, Golden Globe notwithstanding, you know, it's been doing everything it needs to win Best Picture, if you're looking at it from a campaign point of view. And, you know, it's artistically, it's there. I don't think that any of the real criticism that's come with Hurt Locker has come to criticize its artistic merits as a film. You know, maybe it's not as authentic as it is. And certainly the email campaign has nothing to do with the actual merits of the film. So that doesn't affect it at all. I mean, that'll easily sway some people. But, I mean, You know, why would you not vote for Hurt Locker for being inauthentic and then vote for Avatar, which is completely made up? You know, there's a disconnect there. I think Hurt Locker is still on track to win despite these things that have popped up. But certainly it might siphon some votes away. You know, with this new voting system, you could see another film pop up that normally wouldn't.
Now, in sports, they often like to use the I often like to talk after a big game about, did one team win or did another team lose?
Right.
I don't think that's going to happen this year. I think that when Hurt Locker wins Best Picture, it'll be because it deserves Best Picture.
Right.
I think that when Bigelow wins Best Director, it'll be because she wins Best Director. That being said, I think Hurt Locker is going to end up being the big story of this year's Oscars. Do you agree, or do you think that there's going to be another one? Because I don't think you'd be along the lines of saying, well, Avatar lost, because you don't believe that one picture gets voted against another because it's disliked.
Right.
Do you think there's another story, or do you think it's going to be all Hurt Locker this year?
Well, I think, you know, certainly there's a large group of people in the Academy that love the Hurt Locker. So the Hurt Locker is becoming the story of this year's Oscars, you know, with its tying Avatar for the most nominations, but then really being in a much better position to win a lot of these bigger awards. Certainly Kathryn Bigelow is a shoo-in to win director. You know, I think, what, 2 or 3 months ago, we were talking, like, it'll win Best Director, probably won't win anything else. And now we're talking, you know, when you look at the actual nominations and you see what's nominated, especially like in the tech categories, you're like, well, it's got a good chance to win sound mixing, and it's got a good chance to win editing, and it's got a good chance to win all these other awards that it's up for, that you start to realize, you know, when you're looking at a ballot, like the official Academy ballot, and you see all these films, and you're like, well, let's see. Sound, we'll go with this one, and this one will go with this one. And then you get to the end, you get to Best Picture, and you kind of look at your ballot and you go, let's see, it was the best edited film of the year, it was the best shot film of the year, it was the best sounding film of the year. You know, it was the best directed film of the year. Why wouldn't it be the best film of the year? You know, oh,
that's Aviator, except for Best Directed Picture of the Year.
Well, yeah.
I know I talked to you about this before. Mm-hmm. Alec Baldwin, Steve Martin,
right,
hosting. It's a weird thing where they have co-hosts, but one is a comedian and one is an actor. Now, granted, Baldwin nowadays is known mostly for his comic work because he's brilliant in 30 Rock and some of the other pictures that he's done.
Right.
Who would you like to see host the Oscars? And basically, this is a roundabout question because I just want to get back to my answer.
Well, I don't know if I have an easy answer. I mean, there are a lot of MCs that I like that I've seen in other things, like Stephen Fryer, Steve Coogan, that I like, but they don't really fit in with Oscar at all. People like Conan O'Brien, obviously, I don't think fit into Oscar at all.
Did you like Rock when Rock hosted?
Rock was good, although to me, when Rock was hosting, it didn't quite feel, I don't know, so it didn't, something didn't jive.
What about Stewart? Did you like Stewart?
I like Stewart, but like I think what he was saying when he was hosting was there's really no reason for him to be there because he made, what, maybe 2 films and they both sucked. Right.
What about Letterman? Do you like Letterman?
Did anybody like Letterman?
So you're a Billy Crystal kind of guy.
I kind of am. The first Oscars I ever watched was
Singing and Dancing.
It was 1991 and The Silence of the Lambs won. I had no idea.
They rolled him out in a Lecter costume.
I was seven. I had no idea what The Silence of the Lambs was, but it was, you know.
We like Jackman. Billy Crystal was entertaining. Jackman was great. I like Jackman.
Jackman was good. And they didn't invite him back this year, which is odd.
Well, they got new producers.
Ugh. But I wouldn't mind seeing Hugh Jackman host again, actually. So that would probably be my choice for next year. What say you?
Well, thank you for asking. There's a video online that you have to see. It is Robert Downey Jr. presenting at the AFI Lifetime Achievement Award for Warren Beatty. Okay. And it is one of the funniest things, like the funniest 3.5 minutes you'll ever listen to. He's just up at the podium, just riffing. As he does.
Okay.
Ladies and gentlemen, Robert Downey Jr.
Wow. God, there's a lot of love in the room. I'm not feeling it. And I suspect I'm not the only person who's not feeling it. Because, let's face it, there have been casualties along Mr. Beatty's way to glory. There have been traumas sustained by the innocent as he clawed his way to the middle. And sadly, I'm one of those casualties. You see, back in the day, Hal Ashby and I, we were developing a story about a celebrity hairdresser That is when we weren't smoking bong loads and playing Pong. And one day, major breakthrough, a spitball session, primarily focused on making the perfect guacamole recipe. And story, always story. And so Beatty's there, and he abruptly interrupts, and he asks, who the hell are you? Can I say, who am I? I'm your worst nightmare. I'm a 9-year-old stony producer. Hell has got my back. And if you think you're getting 40% on the gross on this one, you are sadly mistaken. So Beatty comes at me with, it's not really even a question. He asks a question that in giving the answer, you'll confuse yourself. He says, what does a kid know about the sexual revolution? I said, please, the sexual revolution is passé. Let's take this premise. We're going to politicize it. We're going to show how the character's sex life and the country's trajectory are simultaneously intersecting and spinning out of control. Now I've got his attention. Now, Ashby piped up, and I quote, Downey, is this guac too lemony? Now, here's the part that hurts. He turns on me, right? He's in my face, and he snarls. He says, you know what, you precocious little snit? You better pump your brakes and show some respect, or one day you may well end up dead, in jail, or in the biggest grossing film of 2008 so far, besides Indy 4. That did it. I wasn't sitting there to be with. I'm 9. I'm stoned. I don't have any rum, raisin, ice cream, and I'm taking it. I leapt out of my beanbag chair and over to where I thought I had left a double-stuffed Oreo cookie, realized it totally wasn't there, regathered my thoughts, and I fired back, hey, Mr. Art imitates life, maybe you should concentrate on mastering your own impulses, or you're going to spend the next 20 years chasing tail like a bobcat after a squirrel, instead of giving us another half a dozen great movies, and then finally meeting a woman that is your equal, settling down, having a family, or maybe both, culminating with being honored 33 years later at the Kodak Theater, which hasn't even been built yet. I've got him. He said, I'm going to produce this. He spanked me for half an hour. He boiled me some milk, a little touch of Bosco in it. Nice touch. Put me down for a nap. And that is how Mr. Beatty came to star in and produce his second film, Bastard Shampoo.
Tell me you want to get turned on by Robert Downey Jr. hosting. I would.
I think I just got a little stiffy talking about it.
I'm still coming over here for Oscar night, right?
You are. I have a place already reserved for you. I used to have a relative that would go out onto the street like the day we were going to go drive down to San Diego to visit, and they would hold a parking spot just for us, and they'd sit out there all day until we got there. I've got a similar situation going with a chair here in my apartment, so no one is sitting down in that chair.
Do you want to do pizzas or like a really big sandwich?
You know, actually, I'm gonna go even further than that. I want to do Oscar themed food. I want to find food that fits with some of the nominated films. You know, like a blue drink for Avatar, or like, you know, some kind of chowder served in a Nazi helmet. You know,
oh, no, we need strudel for Inglourious.
Strudel, Nazi. Yeah, there you go.
And bomb pops for Hurt Locker.
Our main dish should be rations for Hurt Locker.
That's gross. Airline food. We'll have a lot of airline food for like an up in the air.
And of course, our appetizer are prawns for District 9.
Oh, that's so gross, but it's so good. Yeah, that's, right. That's good.